and leaned forward to strike. Holmes leaned away from him, his head almost to the moldy wall, his right elbow on the floor, and kicked his left leg straight, his foot flat as he'd been trained in his youth. The leverage in that leg of his suddenly uncoiled body, carrying enough energy to have kicked in a locked and barred door. Culpepper actually flew upward and backward, so that Holmes caught a glimpse of the soles of his shoes looking like two exclamation marks hanging in midair before Culpepper screamed, and the drizzle, no longer golden, seemed to carry him down into the center of the 10-foot-wide hole in the floor. Holmes paused in the room only long enough to pick up the fallen Beaumont Adams revolver. It was an old weapon, but not unattractive. Wiping it off with his handkerchief, he disassembled it and dropped the pieces down the wide hole. The living, still bleeding Finn tried to push himself further back, literally into the wall, as Holmes passed him with his heavy club swinging idly by his side. The detective could only trust that the surviving Finn had just enough intelligence and not such a serious concussion that he could reliably report these proceedings to Mr. J and his other bosses. Holmes had told Watson more than once that when he, Sherlock Holmes, retired, he was going to write his opus, The Whole Art of Detection. But the book he should really write, Holmes knew, was How to Get Away with a Murder. Rule number 8 would be, never take away anything of the victims. Nothing at all. He closed the door behind him, the surviving Finn still shaking in fear as if he thought Holmes would come back around the hole with its rainbow waterfall to finish the job. And then Holmes was stepping carefully down the stairway. It had borne more weight than it was used to this rainy March day. Holmes did stop in the large room off the lobby. A second broad stain had joined the first. Somehow Culpepper had contrived to land directly on the top of his head. His Homburg was not the better for it, and the sharp, bloody white base of the heavy man's spine had been pushed out through his buttocks. Holmes rolled the body over, taking care to keep even his disguised as poor American bloke's clothes free from stain, and retrieved his $150. He would have use for it in the coming weeks. It was Saturday, March 25th. Holmes expected Henry James to come to his senses soon and return to England or France, but he knew that he himself might have to stay in America at least until the official opening on the 1st of May. President Cleveland was scheduled to push the button that let the fountains jet high, the battleship to fire, and the chorus to unleash the Hallelujah chorus. Holmes would have to stay here in America that unbearable time, unless, of course, circumstances of his own doing, including this encounter, or a telegram from his older brother, released him from such long and tiresome obligations. "'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished," thought Holmes, remembering that evening in 1874 when the 20-year-old Sherlock Holmes, understudy to the lead under a different name entirely, had replaced the suddenly taken ill, bright new acting star in the firmament and troupe director Henry Irving for one glorious night, not as Rosencrantz, not as faithful Horatio, yes, my lord, no, my lord, for 2.5 aching hours, but as Hamlet. The ovation had been standing. The reviews in the Times had been sterling. Irving had fired him from the troupe the next day. Holmes left the mold and blood coppery-smelling old hotel and walked up Casey's Alley until his feet found pavement again. His briefcase and other clothes were where he had placed them in the abandoned house in Foggy Bottom. Holmes took care folding away his American clothes and getting into his Norwegian gentleman's too heavy tweeds. It took him a minute to get the black cover and silver barking dog's head secured in place over the cruder wooden walking stick he'd had to wash along the way. Holmes peered into a glass pane that threw back his reflection. He'd made sure his hands were clean, but now he saw three tiny rosettes of blood line up like crimson snowflakes along his left cheekbone. Wetting his handkerchief in a puddle near a broken window, He dabbed the spots away. Then he tossed away the unmonogrammed handkerchief. Leaving the house with the confidence of an absentee owner after an inspection, Holmes headed back through Foggy Bottom and into the lovely Federalist-style-lined streets closer to the downtown and the executive mansion. His walk now was the wide and confident stride of a famous explorer. His fancy stick now clacked on perfectly laid bricks. Holmes had plenty of time to bathe and change before 5 o'clock tea time. When they all met in the smaller parlor, Holmes thought that Henry James looked especially bleak, as if he had been brooding away the day. But it was obvious that James hadn't yet revealed anything about Holmes's identity to John or Clara Hay. Holmes could see and hear that in his host and hostess's joyous welcomes and easy behavior during the energetic conversation at tea.
"Did you find our quiet city as exciting as your explorations in Asia?" asked Clara Hay.
"Just as stimulating, in its own unique way," replied Jan Sigerson, his Norwegian accent faint but present.
A few hours later, they had roast beef for dinner. It seemed to be a specialty of the Hayes cook, or perhaps they had made it in honor of Henry James, whom they obviously considered more English than American now. Holmes chose his slices very rare. Chapter 13. The weekend turned out to be one of the most painful in Henry James's memory. James's depression had deepened during the long, sleepless night, but with the increase of melancholy had come an increase in clarity. He decided sometime before the day began growing gray at his windows that as soon as Holmes left the Hayes home that Saturday, he would talk to John Hay and make a full confession about his sin, and he fully considered it a sin, against friendship, against all discretion, of bringing this stranger in disguise into the embrace of one of his closest circles of friends. James could not imagine any way that the Hayes and Henry Adams and Clarence King would ever forgive him, and the writer was prepared to skulk away at once, taking the midday train back to New York, there to seek passage back to England. He knew that other fast friends of the Hayes and Adamses, including James's old friend William Dean Howells, would be as equally outraged at his unspeakable behavior. He would accept all their anger and disapprobation. The alternative was to continue this vile charade, and James saw now that he could not do that. He hoped to speak to John Hay alone just after breakfast, but business took Hay out of the house, Jan Sigerson had left for his walk, and Henry James found himself alone with Clara Hay all morning and into the afternoon. As pleasant as Clara had always been to Henry James, he could not bring himself to reveal the truth to her. So they chatted about mutual friends, about the weather in England and on the continent this time of year versus the early spring of Washington, about various sculptors, including Daniel Chester French, Augustus St. Gaudens, and John Singer Sargent, and then about writers again. After the luncheon dishes were removed, they discussed Turgenev's work and Mr. Emerson's essays, which James did not much admire, and others until Clara Hay finally laughed and said,
"You've seen John's library, of course, but you should really see my bookshelves of shameful pleasures, Harry."
James raised an eyebrow.
"Shameful pleasures?" "Yes, you know, books I enjoy tremendously, that John and Henry Adams and Howells and others simply think I should not stoop to read. But I enjoy them. Perhaps you can offer me some dispensation. Come along."
She led him up the wide staircase and down the right hallway toward their master bedrooms. For a horrified instant, James thought that this woman with whom he was alone in the house, save for 6 or 8 servants, was going to lead him into her bed sitting room, but she stopped in the hall outside. The bookcase there was of polished mahogany and was at least 12 feet long.
"Yellow-backed books," he exclaimed. "Yes, I can't resist picking them up at the railway stations when I'm traveling in England," said Clara Hay.
and set the fingers of both hands against her reddening cheeks.
Have you ever succumbed to the temptation, Harry?
He smiled with what he hoped looked like friendly benevolence.
Of course, my dear woman. The yellow-backed books are designed to while away a boring railway trip. I see you have Collins's The Moonstone and The Woman in White there amongst your other sensationalist novels.
Still blushing, Clara said,
Oh, yes, how I enjoy Wilkie Collins's books, and how sorry I was when he passed away 4 years ago.
I do read serious books as well, you know.
If I remember correctly, you were among the first of the Five of Hearts to discover my work, said James,
removing a few of the volumes from the bookcase of third and second-rate H. Rider Haggard-style adventure romances and glancing at titles before setting them back. Not all of the books here, not even a majority, were actually yellow-backed British novels that invariably dealt with bigamy, illegitimacy, murder, blackmail, and the like, but all were sensationalist novels.
Oh, long before Clover's The Five of Hearts began meeting, Harry, John and I were each reading your work when we met.
What is this? Asked James, removing a crisp new volume with a light tan binding. On the spine, it read, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, and lower on the spine and below that, boxed, The Strand Library.
I became addicted to Mr. Conan Doyle's stories when John and I spent 3 months in London 2 years ago, said Clara. But they don't sell the Strand magazine here, so when I heard that they were releasing that collection of the Strand's Sherlock Holmes stories here last month, a dozen stories in all, I purchased it immediately.
Last month, you say, murmured James, leafing through the indifferently bound book. There were illustrations.
It appeared in February? Yes.
May I borrow this, Clara?
Asked Henry James, slapping the book shut and lifting it.
My gout is acting up, and I could use some amusing light reading to take my mind off it.
Of course, said Clara Hay, blushing again.
Just do not tell John what kind of book I've lent to such an illustrious author. I would never hear the end of it.
The two stood in the hallway smiling at one another, like two conspirators. With his gout as an excuse, and it was acting up, causing his left foot to ache something terribly, James spent the rest of the afternoon in his room. A girl came in to build up the fire, and James sat close to it, his aching foot up on an overstuffed footstool, as a light rain began to tap and streak the windows. Edmund Goss and his other younger friends who enjoyed and recommended Henry Rider Haggard's jungle adventures and the supposedly true Sherlock Holmes tales in The Strand, or the longer Holmes pieces in Beaton's Christmas Annual, hadn't told James much detail about the Conan Doyle tales, other than it was their perception that Doyle was the literary agent and editor, a sort of collaborator for Dr. John H. Watson's True Tales of the Reclusive, but evidently very busy, London detective. James had attempted to read precisely one H. Rider Haggard romance, but when he came to a graphic scene whereby the white hunter blew his black native bearer's brains out rather than allow his man to be tortured, James had set aside the book and all thoughts of reading future Haggard for good. Glimpses of life on the streets of London were difficult enough to reconcile with a graceful, dignified life. James wanted to encounter no more lovingly detailed descriptions of skulls exploding and brain matter flying free. The Holmes stories he had never been even slightly curious about. Thinking back now to Mrs. O'Connor's and Lady Wolseley's benefit garden party where he had been introduced to Sherlock Holmes 4 years earlier, James could remember that A. Conan Doyle had been on the guest list. Several popular but not very highly thought of authors had been a part of the charity effort, but he couldn't remember being introduced to Conan Doyle or talking with him. He had no memory of any Dr. John H. Watson being present at the affair. Shifting his swollen and slippered foot so that it would be more comfortable, nodding his thanks to the footman who'd brought him his tea with lemon, James settled back and began reading the 12 stories in The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. James recognized his traveling companion through Dr. Watson's, or perhaps Conan Doyle's, descriptions. The lean physique, oversized pale forehead, gaunt cheeks, hawk-like nose, expressive eyebrows, and intense gray-eyed gaze. Although the illustrator for the Strand stories, a certain Sidney Paget, showed a man much better looking and even more the gentleman than the real Holmes. Of course, James realized, he'd not yet fully seen the real Sherlock Holmes, dressed fully as himself and behaving fully like himself. If there were a real Sherlock Holmes. In the first story, A Scandal in Bohemia, James was shocked to encounter the King of Bohemia, whom Holmes had clearly identified as the Prince of Wales, while the two were late dining at Café de la Paix a mere 12 days earlier. James thought the quality of prose something less than mere serviceable, and the plot ridiculous. Holmes's machinations to retrieve the incriminating photograph for the Prince of Wales were contrived and absurd, and in the end, unsuccessful. A mere female adventuress had outsmarted him at every turn. If this tale were true, why would Holmes, whose income seems to flow only through these private clients, ever allow Dr. Watson to work with Conan Doyle to publish the details of such a singular failure? Even more interesting to Henry James was the sense, sometimes emerging from between the lines or a sardonic comment, that Holmes, at least the character of Holmes as shown in this odd tale, holds the King of Bohemia, England's actual Prince of Wales, in something like cold contempt. At the end of the tale, Holmes seems to be glad that he had been beaten and that Irene Adler had retained the incriminating photograph. James also noticed that Watson, or Conan Doyle, had referred to the adventuress as the late Irene Adler. The Red-Headed League was more amusing, but Henry James found the detective's startling deductions in the tale merely silly. Nowhere in either of these stories had the author, whoever he really was, attempted to get into the minds or motivations of any of the characters. Watson insisted on viewing his flatmate at 221B Baker Street with awe, no matter the level of idiocy Holmes was perpetuating. Proofreading errors were rampant. The red-headed character named Wilson started work simply sitting in a room for 4 hours a day and copying pages from the Encyclopedia Britannica. On April 29th, 1890, after 8 weeks' work and £32 paid for his labors, Wilson shows up promptly at the empty room, save for table and chair where he sits to copy, and finds a note pinned to the door. The Red-Headed League is dissolved, October 9th, 1890. But, and James did this calculation in his head, the 8 weeks and £32 would have brought Wilson and the story only to June 23rd, not October 9th, and Wilson would have been owed an extra £58.10.02 were it actually October 9th. The author also has Wilson mentioning that he was moving into the B's in the encyclopedia at the time the Red-Headed League was dissolved and he lost his silly job. Holmes had noticed the recent 1889 ninth edition of the encyclopedia in a hallway bookcase, and Henry James rang for a manservant to fetch the first volume of the Britannica. After actually counting the words on an average page in the first section, James hobbled over to the room's small writing desk, retrieved some foolscap and a pencil, and figured that the character of Jabez Wilson had copied some 6,419,616 words in 8 weeks' work, and that while copying for only 4 hours a day. With a little division on his foolscap, James averaged this to a rate of some 33,435 words per hour, or a little over 557 words per minute. Extraordinary. Ridiculous. The author, whether Watson or Conan Doyle, literally had not done his arithmetic. On another page of the same story, the careless writer has Holmes, Watson, a constable, and others suffering a long drive through an endless labyrinth of gas-lit streets, even though their objective would have been only a short walk from where the party had started. In another part of the story, Henry James could not stop himself from laughing out loud. Holmes has announced that the mystery facing him was a three-pipe problem, and then drew his legs up into his chair and, using a disreputable black clay pipe that James had seen the detective smoke while on their trip here, supposedly smoked three pipes of shag tobacco in 50 minutes. James knew that one shag of such rough tobacco in an hour would almost certainly ruin any man's throat and nose membranes. Three shags would probably kill a man. In the Boscombe Valley mystery, the Holmes character is his usual arrogant, condescending self to Watson, a man older and certainly more experienced in life and war than the so-called consulting detective, but he also continues to prove that he has no right to act that way. At the first news of a murder in the mythical Boscombe Valley, near the very real city of Ross in Herefordshire, Holmes has Watson join him in a pell-mell, earliest train possible rush to the city and crime scene. But once Holmes arrives in Ross, he inexplicably takes 2 days off in the hotel there before venturing out to the outdoor crime scene where a man had died by having his skull caved in. Holmes even emphasizes the absolute importance of inspecting that crime scene before it rains and all evidence is washed away, but then is satisfied that the weather shall remain no wind and not a cloud in the sky by consulting a barometer which reports the pressure at 29. Now, Henry James was no meteorologist, and to the best of his recollection, he had never used a barometer reading as a plot point in any of his stories or novels, but he had spent enough time with farmers, both back in New England and in England and France, and with sea captains during his various crossings of the Atlantic, to know that a reading of 29 does not ensure good weather. Indeed, if, with that reading, a serious rainstorm had not arrived, it was certainly on the way. After a day lost not viewing the crime scene, Holmes again refers to the barometer reading of 29 as promising fine weather and proceeds to waste another day that should have been close to typhoon weather. Holmes then solves the mystery largely due to inferring that the murdered man's seemingly incomprehensible last words to his accused of murder son, a rat, actually must mean Ballarat in Australia. Therefore, the murderer had to be from Ballarat. But even granted the identity of the murderer as Australian and Henry James's personal lack of knowledge of the continent, one flip open of the first volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica showed James that there were several other Australian towns and regions that ended with a rat, including Ararat. James's dismay at the lack of proofreading, as well as the carelessness of the writing itself, was not diminished in the story called The Man with the Twisted Lip, when Dr. John Watson's wife, visited in the night by a distraught and veiled lady whom she soon sees to be a certain acquaintance known to her as Kate Whitney, says, "It was very sweet of you to come. Now you must have some wine and water, and sit here comfortably and tell us all about it. Or should you rather that I sent James off to bed?" James, thought Henry James in growing contempt. The gentleman in question, unless Mrs. Watson had a lover hiding under the table, had to be her husband, John Watson. Doesn't this author even bother to proofread his work? In the same story, Holmes reveals the true identity of a filthy prisoner by rubbing his face lightly with a large, wet sponge he's been thoughtful enough to bring to the prison, thus removing, according to the author of the tale, layers of actor's grease paint. Henry James, who had spent much of the previous 18 months traveling around England with an acting troupe putting on his first play, The American, knew from simple observation that Holmes's wet sponge would have just mottled and muddled an actor's disguise. All of the actors and actresses James had watched removing their makeup first had to carefully apply a layer of cold cream before beginning to remove theatrical makeup. And so it went, story after story, idiocy after idiocy. James set aside the collection only when a footman came up to announce that everyone was meeting in the parlor for tea or drinks before dinner. He did not have to feign his limp when going down, and at John Hay's concerned questioning, James admitted that his gout, about which he'd written Hay the previous December, was indeed acting up. The dinner, although so limited in number it was essentially dîner en famille, was roast beef for which James had little appetite this particular evening. John Hay was expansive, happy, and perfect as their host. Clara was kind and sure that everyone was involved in the conversation. Jan Sigerson described his pleasure at seeing the gleaming white capital and other such wonders, including what James considered the wedding cake baroque on baroque monstrosity of the State Department just down the street, where Hay had worked for so many years. And James was quiet, save for nods of attention and various smiles of appreciation. The others must have put his quietness down to his gout, although it was more or less characteristic of Henry James at any table. In truth, James was carefully observing this Sherlock Holmes, Jan Sigerson person. Yes, it had been he, James, who had recognized Holmes in the almost absolute darkness along the Seine, for despite the actor's putty on the nose, added hair, and other makeup, none of which would come off with a simple pass of a wet sponge, the hawk look of that lean face remained. But James was beginning to have a different feeling about both Holmes and about his own plan to talk to John Hay privately after dinner, and there, with endless apologies, expose the hoax and humbug he'd brought to the Hayes household. No, tomorrow would serve. James saw how it would be better to wait until the real explorer and mountain climber, Clarence King, exposed Holmes for the fraud he was. Or, failing that, the certainty of the Norwegian emissary tripping up Holmes's clumsy and shallow disguise. Then James could act as shocked and deceived as everyone else at the table. It would be embarrassing, yes, but it wouldn't necessarily put Henry James beyond the pale with these old friends. Holmes would be banished. James would apologize to John and Clara for his own unforgivable naivete in believing the man. He would leave almost immediately to sail to England, and that would be that. Hay invited the men into his library for brandy and cigars, but after quickly finishing his drink there, James pled gout again and went back upstairs, leaving his host and Sigerson energetically discussing the European gold situation, the recent slaughter of thousands of Arabs by Congo cannibals, and the possible injustice of canal builder de Lesseps' imprisonment for fraud. Chapter 14. James read into the night. The authorial and plot idiocies continued to accrue. But here and there, James did see elements of the Sherlock Holmes character which reminded him of the man he'd met 13 days earlier and with whom he'd dined that night. And he began to understand, dimly, the attraction of these adventures to educated friends of his such as Edmund Gosse. The heart of the adventures of Sherlock Holmes lay not in the clumsy adventures, which never struck James as that adventurous, but rather in the friendship between Holmes and Watson, their breakfasts together, the foggy days shared indoors by the crackling fire, and Mrs. Hudson coming and going with her food trays and messages from the world. Holmes and Watson lived in a boys' adventure universe, and like Peter Pan, and despite Watson's rather confused mentions of being married, neither of them ever grew up. In The Adventure of the Noble Bachelor, which, like so many of the other Holmesian adventures, was no adventure at all, but just a vulgar domestic misunderstanding in the flimsy guise of a mystery, a certain Lord Robert St. Simon of high birth visits 221B Baker Street to seek advice, and Holmes is instantly rude to him. Besides botching the title and crying, "Good day, Lord St. Simon," rather than the proper Lord Robert or Lord Robert St. Simon, Holmes immediately insults his guest and client. Henry James had to stop himself at the last minute from marking the following passage in Clara's book with pencil or pen. Lord Robert, who has been left at the altar by an American bride, is speaking.
A most painful matter to me, as you most readily imagine, Mr. Holmes. I have been cut to the quick. I understand that you already managed several delicate cases of this sort, sir, though I presume that they were hardly from the same class of society.
No, I am descending.
I beg pardon?
My last client of the sort was a king.
Oh, really? I had no idea. And which king?
The King of Scandinavia.
What? Had he lost his wife?
You can understand, said Holmes suavely, that I extend to the affairs of my other clients the same secrecy which I promised to you in yours.
What utter bombast, thought James. Any gentleman with a shred of discretion might have mentioned similar details in another case, but would not be so indiscreet as to mention the name of another client, especially not a royal one.
It was all a reverse snobbery that James had heard from Holmes, or at least from the man downstairs who might be pretending to be Sherlock Holmes, in the same penumbra of insanity that led him to pretend that he was Holmes pretending to be explorer Jan Sigerson. And it led, along with so many other clues, both in these adventures and in James's time with the detective, to one conclusion. Sherlock Holmes was no gentleman. He was simply someone gifted in disguises who had been play-acting for years at being a gentleman, cultivating the casual dress, bored air, and upper-class educated accents of a true gentleman, but never showing the soul of one. The last story in the adventures of Sherlock Holmes, read with the window open because of a growing warmth in the air and with moths batting at the lamp, made the usually staid Henry James stifle his laughter with his hand over his mouth. It would not do to have the Hayes servants, or perhaps the other guests down the hall, hear gout-ridden Henry James laughing aloud after midnight. The final story in the collection was The Adventure of the Copper Beeches, and it was a fitting finale, since it included all of the authorial sloppiness, logical idiocies, and Holmesian blunders that made the other stories all but unreadable. Here they were gathered into a primary mass of one sensationalist writer's execrable laziness. The story starts with an attractive but far too familiar young lady, a stranger to Holmes and Watson, but one acting as if she were already an intimate of the detective, a certain Violet Hunter, appearing one morning and demanding the great detective's advice on an earth-shattering matter. Should she take a well-paying job as governess for the son of an immensely fat man named Jeffro Rucastle? Mr. Rucastle's interview with her was odd because he declared himself and his wife as fatty and said her employment would require her to wear a certain dress
or to sit here or sit there. That would not be offensive to you?
Miss Hunter declares herself shocked to hear of the idea of her wearing certain clothing, although all domestic servants and many governesses of the era were required to do so, and the warnings of orders to sit here or sit there were foolish for Rucastle to mention if he had dark intentions. The lord and lady of households routinely ordered their domestics and governesses around. Then Mr. Rucastle informed Violet Hunter that she would have to cut her lovely and luxuriant hair short. At this outrageous condition, Miss Hunter turned down the job offer, but kept thinking about the high salary, and after a few days came close to changing her mind. Then a letter arrived from Rucastle, still insisting on the cut hair and wearing of certain clothes as a condition, but raising her proposed salary to £30 a quarter. A fortune for a governess, especially one with the admittedly limited education and experience of Miss Violet Hunter.
That is the letter which I have just received, Mr. Holmes, and my mind is made up that I will accept it.
Then what in Hades are you doing wasting this detective's time in asking for advice if you've already decided?
Softly hissed Henry James in the moth-circling night. With the certainty of the machineries of plotting, thudding, and racketing along, drowning all logic and careful introspection, The telegram, which we eventually received, came late one night.
Please be at the Black Swan Hotel at Winchester at midnight, tomorrow. Do come. I am at my wit's end. Hunter.
This wasn't a telegram. It was a royal summons. So naturally, Holmes and Watson are thundering toward Winchester in a morning train. In this sequence, the interesting part, from what James's brother William would have called a psychological perspective, was this rather amazing outburst from Holmes as he looks at the peaceful English countryside beyond London and comments upon the bucolic homes and cottages.
I look at them, and the only thought which comes to me is a feeling of their isolation, and of the impunity with which crime may be committed there. Good heavens, I cried. Who would associate crime with these dear old homesteads? They always fill me with a certain horror. It is my belief, Watson, founded upon my experience, that the lowest and vilest alleys in London do not present a more dreadful record of sin than does the smiling and beautiful countryside.
You horrify me.
But the reason is very obvious. The pressure of public opinion can do in the town what the law cannot accomplish. There is no lane so vile that the scream of a tortured child or the thud of a drunkard's blow does not beget sympathy and indignation among the neighbors, and then the whole machinery of justice is ever so close that a word of complaint can set it doing, and there is but a step between the crime and the dock. But look at these lovely houses, each in its own fields, filled for the most part with poor, ignorant folk who know little of the law. Think of the deeds of hellish cruelty, the hidden wickedness which go on year in, year out in such places, and none the wiser.
Henry James had lived in England long enough to know that this was pure twaddle. There were certainly instances of crime and domestic brutality in any picturesque village or cottage, but none of the wanton crime, neglect, and lack of law that Holmes here states absurdly would be so quickly reported and corrected, with punishment invariably handed out in the slums and tenements of London. Indeed, the cruelty of Henry James's favorite city was known to all of its urban inhabitants. What struck Henry James in this silly outburst of the literary Sherlock Holmes was twofold. First, it was not an English attitude about the city versus country. In fact, it was decidedly un-English. French, perhaps, Russian, possibly, but never English. Second, James could all but hear his brother William's strong voice saying, "This is a sort of confession from the man's own background, Harry, a psychological plea for help and understanding. Something very dark and painful happened to this man in the country some time in his past, a countryside he was not used to, being a former city slum dweller, perhaps, and his subconscious now loathes and fears the very idea of bucolic quiet and those stretches of peaceful darkness between the country homes and cottages. It would be very interesting to explore the basis for this man's deep fears." Henry James occasionally lectured on great writers, but should he ever give a symposium on ludicrous writing, he would use as his text the rest of The Adventure of the Copper Beeches. Miss Hunter, her hair now cropped short in a way that reminded James, with a pang, of his teenaged cousin, now deceased, Minnie Temple, posing as Hamlet for them after a serious illness had caused her hair to be roughly shorn, meets Holmes and Watson at the Black Swan Hotel. Evidently, she is a governess who has no problem leaving her young charge, the Rue Castle's only child, a son, Edward, described only as having a huge and oversized head and of being evil, at any time of the day or night. Indeed, other than her ascertaining that the odd-looking boy is evil, there is no mention of Miss Hunter's governess duties or interactions with the boy. The Rue Castles have informed Violet Hunter that their daughter, who looked very much like Violet Hunter, had died of brain fever, which was the reason for the daughter's shortened hair. And now Hunter informs a solicitous Holmes and Watson that she has been made to sit in front of a bow window, with her back to the window, of course, in the dead daughter's dress, and laugh aloud at Mr. Rucastle's endless trove of amusing anecdotes. When Violet secreted a small mirror into her handkerchief to look out the window behind her, she saw a young man standing at the fence to the property, staring intently at her back. But the humorless Mrs. Rucastle noticed the mirror, exclaimed that there was an intruder on the property, and demanded that Violet wave him away before they immediately lowered the blinds. Miss Hunter then easily unlocks a locked drawer in a chest of drawers in her room and finds a coil of hair that has precisely the color and texture of her own when it had been long. As established forever in such gothic tales as Jane Eyre, there was the inevitable locked room, in fact an entire locked wing, which Miss Violet Hunter was told to avoid. Naturally, she soon finds a key, inevitably, conveniently, left in the lock there, and explores the empty, dusty wing, empty save for one room which is also locked, with the iron headboard from a bed used as bars across it. She does not have time to go inside. Mr. Rucastle almost immediately learns of her transgression and threatens to feed her to the large mastiff named Carlo that he orders the single manservant named Toller to loose from the kennel to prowl the grounds at night. Toller, it seems, has drunk himself into oblivion that very afternoon. Holmes immediately announces that she must lock Mrs. Toller in the cellar that evening, and that he and Dr. Watson, carrying his trusty service revolver, will be at Copper Beeches at 7 p.m. Holmes has stated that it is obvious that Mr. Rucastle has imprisoned his still-living daughter, Judy, in the locked room for some nefarious reason, probably about an inheritance he wants to control, and the three adventurers have soon broken through the locks and bedstead grill and flung open the door, only to find
it was empty. There was no furniture save a little pallet bed, a small table, and a basket full of linen. The skylight above was open, and the prisoner gone.
"There has been some villainy here," said Holmes. "This beauty has guessed Miss Hunter's intentions, and has carried his victim off."
"But how?"
"Through the skylight. We shall soon see how he managed it."
He swung himself up onto the roof.
"Ah, yes," he cried. "Here's the end of a long, light ladder against the eaves. That is how he did it."
"But it is impossible," said Miss Hunter. "The ladder was not there when the Rucastles went away."
"He has come back and done it. I tell you that he is a clever and dangerous man."
Here Henry James cannot resist the soft laughter that overcame him. A clever and dangerous man, who for some reason found it necessary to bring a tall ladder to his own home, cross the roof, and drop through a skylight to retrieve a young woman from a room to which he had the keys and could easily unlock and walk in, and take his daughter out the normal way, should he need to, any time he chose. This was typical of Holmes's deductions, and, James thought, it was typically asinine. The end of the story was almost apologetically pro forma. Rucastle appears.
"You villain," cries Holmes. "Where is your daughter?"
Then Rucastle rushes out to free Carlo, the giant mastiff, who we know from Mr. Toller's 2 days of reported drunkenness has not been fed for 2 days. Our trio hears the baying of a hound, another authorial idiocy, James notes tiredly. Although Henry James prefers small dogs, lap dogs suitable for parlors, such as dachshunds, he's been around all breeds of dogs enough at other people's country homes to know that mastiffs, which are usually quite gentle around people, are incapable of baying. Growling, perhaps, roaring from the chest when threatened, perhaps, but baying, never. That ability to bay belongs to the hounds group of canines, and a mastiff is not a hound. At any rate, Carlo chews out Mr. Rucastle's throat. Dr. Watson, with his trusty service revolver, blew its brains out, but too late, alas, and a suddenly helpful Mrs. Toller explains the entire plot, the need for Rucastle to fake his daughter Judy's death, for inheritance reasons, and hide her away in the locked wing.
And the whole pantomime of Violet Hunter being made to impersonate Judy so that the daughter's persistent fiancé, a Mr. Fowler, whom Violet Hunter glimpsed in her mirror, will give up, accept Judy's death, and go away. In one final paragraph, all the loose ends are tied and tidied up. We never meet Judy or Mr. Fowler, but hear from the narrator that they were married and that the lucky groom is now the holder of a government appointment in the island of Mauritius, and that Miss Violet Hunter has gone on, perhaps with the help of Sherlock Holmes, to be the head of a private school at Walsat. A rather good job for a young woman with no real references, who admitted in the story that she had as skills only a little music, a tiny bit of French and German. Henry James, setting the finished book on his bedside table, again has to press his knuckles against his lips, lest an audible laugh escape. The writer, Dr. John H. James Watson, Arthur Conan Doyle, a bizarre blend of the two hacks, has forgotten all about the son, Edward, the boy with the oversized head and reported penchant for evil. It's obvious that all of the characters, including his former governess, Miss Hunter, had also forgotten that Edward was supposed to exist. With the happy ending of Mr. Rucastle having his throat torn out by a hungry and impossibly baying mastiff, Edward just seems to have vanished. Poof! Lying in the warm darkness, James thinks of a future story about a governess that he's contemplated writing from time to time. His story, should he ever write it, would be from the governess's mentally clouded point of view and would deal with a palpable, although imagined, evil that seems to threaten the child or children in the remote country house. James sees it as a ghost story without any certain ghost, and knows it will require the lightest and subtlest of touches to make the increasingly nervous reader begin to wonder if the governess is insane or evil, or if it is the children who are evil. Or perhaps there is a ghost, or ghosts, James hasn't decided, despite all the psychological suggestions to the contrary. His brother William would almost certainly like such a psychological tale. All James knows for certain is that the tale will require all of his hard-earned skills and the most delicate of authorial brushstrokes to help the reader slowly become aware of the multiple levels of honesty, lying, guilt, and innocence, not even to mention survival, even while keeping the story explicit enough to chill the reader to goosebumps. But everywhere and always, he will have to leave the reader in deep doubt about what has really happened and which of the events are only in the increasingly unstable governess's mind. Smiling slightly from the pathetic absurdities of the copper beaches and thinking ever so gently of ghosts and of the human mind in murky conflict with itself, Henry James falls asleep in the warm Washington night.
Chapter 15. Sunday was quiet in the sprawling Hay household, at least until Henry James cornered Sherlock Holmes. Clara Hay had gone to church after informing everyone that she would be doing some charity volunteer work for hours after the church service proper. John Hay had hosted his two guests at breakfast, but then disappeared into his beautiful study for hours of his own sort of literary or historical devotion. The huge home was quiet, except for the reassuring sound of horses' hooves and buggy wheels on the street outside, and the occasional nun-like hushed rustle of servants moving efficiently to and fro within the light-filled, mahogany-scented mansion. It was late morning when Henry James knocked on Jan Sigerson's guest room door. Holmes, smoking cheap shag tobacco in his disreputable black clay pipe, let the writer in and beckoned to an extra chair near the window where he'd been reading. James was carrying a book of his own, but he carefully kept the cover and spine hidden while the two men took their seats.
Clarence King will be here in a few hours, said James.
Yes, said Holmes. I'm very much looking forward to meeting him.
I think
you should not.
Henry James's soft voice could be firm to the point of hardness when he willed it to be. He willed it so now.
I beg your pardon.
Holmes batted the ashes from the old pipe into a crystalline ashtray on a side table.
I think you should not put the household through this farce, said James. John Hay may be busy in his study until tea time. I propose that you pack your bags and leave while you can.
And why would I do that? Holmes asked softly.
Henry Adams won't even be back until sometime next week. I've hardly begun the investigation into his wife's death.
That's all humbug, snapped James. Clover Adams suffered from a melancholic disposition. She fell to a low after her father's death and never recovered. Melancholy ran in her family, as her brother Ned's suicide attests. Turning it into a mystery is humbug.
Holmes looked as if he were interested in what the writer was saying.
Then what about the annual "She Was Murdered" notes sent to...
More humbug,
Henry James said firmly.
I shall not allow you to reopen old griefs in such a way. I have no idea why I've gone along with your insanities this long. But no matter. It must end today. You pack and leave, and I shall think of something to tell the Hayes and Clarence King and the others. I myself shall leave early tomorrow.
So you no longer think me capable of solving this mystery?
Asked Holmes, repacking and relighting his pipe.
I no longer think that you are Sherlock Holmes.
There, thought James, I've said it. The other man looked up from his pipe with obvious surprise and an even greater expression of interest.
James, it was you who identified me from memory, despite my Sigerson disguise near Le Pont Neuf.
I was mistaken.
Or perhaps I had met you at Mrs. O'Connor's garden party 4 years ago, but you were in disguise then as well.
In disguise as...
Sherlock Holmes. A fictional character.
Oh-ho!
Cried the man whom James had known as Holmes.
So now you agree with me that Sherlock Holmes does not really exist. What changed your mind, James?
This. The writer held out the tan edition of The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
May I?
Asked the man with the pipe. He took the book gently in his long, strong fingers and began to flip through it.
I was vaguely aware that the American edition of Watson's collected Strand stories was coming out this year, but I had no idea it would be published here so early.
Last month, said James, and wished that he hadn't spoken.
The illustrations by Sidney Paget are rather good, aren't they?
Asked the other man. His tone held mild amusement.
If they purport to be of you, said James, they flatter you.
Oh, absolutely, cried Holmes.
He removed the pipe from between his teeth as he laughed.
But you see, I've never met Mr. Sidney Paget, nor have I allowed a photograph to be taken of me. Paget uses his brother as a model for his Sherlock Holmes, or so I am told. His brother is an even more well-known illustrator, and Watson informed me that the Strand people had meant to hire him rather than his brother Sidney. But the letter went to the wrong Paget.
James stared blankly at Holmes, at the man whom he still thought of as Holmes, until finally he could stand the silence no longer. The smoke from the shag tobacco made him cough before he could get a sentence out.
I now believe, sir, that you are some person, some deranged person, pretending to be the fictional character Sherlock Holmes, who in turn is pretending to be a fictional explorer named Jan Sigerson.
Oh, I say, cried Holmes,
removing his pipe again and smiling most broadly.
Very good, James. Very good indeed. That hypothesis makes much more sense than my own. That is, that I simply don't exist outside these little...
He held up the book.
Fictions.
So you admit it, said Henry James. He felt a strange and not very pleasant, but quite persistent, invisible weight press against his chest.
Admit that I am deranged? I can hardly defend myself against that accusation. Admit that I am someone other than the possibly, quite probably, fictional character Sherlock Holmes? Alas, I cannot confess to that, sir. I am either the real Sherlock Holmes, or the fictional simulacrum of same. Those are my sad choices at the moment.
James felt something like panic pluck at him. The other man was deranged, and he might well be dangerous, a physical threat to James, even at this moment.
Oh, I think not dangerous, said Holmes,
puffing away again.
Not to you, at least, Mr. James.
It was as if he'd plucked the author's thoughts out of the air.
What did you think of Watson's stories?
Asked Holmes, closing the book and setting it on the table next to James. They're absurd. Holmes laughed again.
Yes, they are, aren't they? Poor Watson works so hard to bring the rough notes of his chronicles up to Conan Doyle's literary standards. But I doubt if either man understands how the reality of my cases could ever really be translated into any work of art. You see, James, the better cases already are works of art, without the melodrama and fictional trappings.
So, you admit that these stories are inferior literary efforts, managed James. Mere overwrought romances. Holmes winced at the last word, but sounded amiable enough as he said,
Absolutely, my dear chap.
He opened the book again.
I see that Watson included the tale he called The Copper Beeches. Shall we just take that as an example of literary failure?
I already have taken it as such, said James.
As well you should, said Holmes,
prodding the stem of his pipe in James's direction.
I ask you, does it make any sense whatsoever that this...
He had to fan through pages and glance down at the story.
That this Violet Hunter person should come to our apartment and take up our time, Watson's and mine, asking advice on whether she takes some dreary governess position in the country? No matter how odd her employer's requirements might have been, I mean. And does it make sense that I would waste my time listening to such a plea for advice? Unnecessary advice, since you may have noticed that the baggage had already made up her mind about taking the position.
Total nonsense, said James. He felt a sense of oddness verging on vertigo that he was agreeing with Holmes, or vice versa.
This Violet Hunter, that wasn't the wench's real name, of course, was not my client.
No? James would have called back the syllable if he'd been able to.
No. Our client, the person in need of help who showed up on this cold day in early March of 1886, was the Mr. Fowler, to whom Watson refers, but who is never directly introduced to the reader.
Mr. Fowler? Repeated James, despite himself. The imprisoned Alice Rucastle's fiancé? The man in the mirror? The one whom Dr. Watson informs us ends up marrying the liberated Miss Rucastle and moves with her to Mauritius? Holmes grinned around the pipe in a way that looked almost evil.
Precisely, he said. Although Mr. Fowler, I shall call him Peter since that was the gentleman's real first name, did not, as it turned out, marry the liberated and enriched Miss Alice Rucastle and, how did Watson put it?
He flipped pages.
Oh yes, become the holder of a government appointment in the island of Mauritius.
Is any of this relevant, or of any importance whatsoever to your fraudulent representation of yourself as Sherlock Holmes? Asked James.
Only if you wish to understand the wide gap between this fictional Sherlock Holmes's life and his reported adventures, said Holmes,
I see no purpose to discussing either, said Henry James. Holmes nodded in agreement but removed the pipe and began speaking in slow, low tones.
Peter Fowler came to see Dr. Watson and me in March of 1888. His problem was a domestic one, yes, but one which I thought at the time might serve my need to some true detection. In the end, you see, James, Mr. Fowler, who was a very nice London gentleman, by the by, did not marry Miss Alice Rucastle and live happily ever after. The truth of the matter, the sort of truth that Watson so frequently works so hard to avoid, was that his former fiancée, Alice Rucastle, tore Fowler's throat out with her teeth. She murdered him.
Good God, breathed James.
Mr. Fowler came to me because he'd been happily engaged to Alice Rucastle. Watson's clumsy choice of a name, of course. Until what Fowler had referred to as his fiancée's pleasant, if frequent, flightiness had turned into a severe brain fever, whatever brain fever might actually be. Watson, like most medicos in our benighted era, swears by brain fever. But not one doctor in 1,000 can describe its cause or cure.
But Miss Rucastle, whatever her real name might be, did have it? Asked James. His weakness for hearing bizarre stories was almost the equal of his penchant for writing them.
She had it, but her infant younger brother, Edward, was the one who died from it, said Holmes.
Edward, repeated James. He remembered the moths circling the lamp late the night before as he approached sleep and the end of the collection of tales. The little boy with evil behavior and the oversized head. The object of Miss Violet Hunter's efforts of instruction as a governess. Holmes laughed again.
Miss Violet Hunter was not hired as a governess. Baby Edward had been murdered by the time Mr. and Mrs. Rucastle hired her, and they hired her only to impersonate their imprisoned daughter, Alice.
Wait, said Henry James, holding up one well-manicured hand. You're saying that Violet Hunter, by any other name, knew from the start that she had no duty except to impersonate the imprisoned daughter of the Rucastles? Mr. Fowler's fiancée?
That's precisely what I'm saying, James.
Holmes stared out the window at leaf shadows on St. John's across the street.
Violet Hunter was nothing more than a woman of the streets. In company, she could not have impersonated even so lowly a lady as a governess. Mr. Jeffro Rucastle, who, by the by, was no villain, as Watson recreated it, but who also was soon to die violently, made it clear to the London wench from the start that she would be paid £30 a month, not a quarter, as Watson's retelling has it, £30 a month, just to cut her hair as Alice's had been cut during her terrible illness, to wear Alice's blue dress, to sit in the window where Peter Fowler could, from behind her and from a distance, see her laughing and evidently recovered from her madness.
Her madness? Gasped James.
Oh, yes. I forgot to put that little fact in sequence, didn't I? This is why Watson says that I must never write up my own adventures. When Alice's father, Alice was her real Christian name, by the way, when her father realized that she would never regain her sanity, he wrote to Peter Fowler in a poor imitation of his daughter's hand to break off their engagement. But Fowler never believed that the letter was from Alice.
Alice Rucastle was mad?
As a hatter,
said Holmes with absolutely no tone of sympathy in his voice.
It had manifested itself in sly and then secret but serious ways for years. But during the winter of her engagement to Peter Fowler, a marriage which her parents did not know of and would never have allowed since the insanity was hereditary, the worsening illness led first to the fits, then to the seizures, and finally to the violent behavior that the Rucastles reported to Fowler and the world as brain fever.
But surely Mr. Fowler would have understood, said James. He tried to imagine writing this tale himself. but failed. It was too sensationalist, too much the fever dream territory of a contemporary Wilkie Collins.
Understood that in her violent madness, Alice Rucastle had murdered and partially eaten her 2-year-old younger brother, Edward?
Holmes asked blandly.